The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
I think you have to draw really firm lines about what is it, where is it acceptable to mess around and where is it not. It's not possible to say nobody can mess with anything in the United States. You know, touching a United States network or computer is unacceptable. Or even, you know, a government system, right? You have to send very firm messages about, for example, you mess with our political parties, we're annoyed, maybe we'll retaliate, but you touch our election infrastructure and there will be a consequence. And I think the administration has a little bit gone all in on this notion of, well, we want to be ambiguous, right? We don't want people to know exactly where the thresholds are because we don't want to sort of allow people to do just what they can get away with. I think that it maybe is not working here, right? There is some validity in saying, all right, this is the stuff we just will not tolerate.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, October 15th, 2016. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security and the Office of the Director of National Intelligence have announced that, quote, the U.S. intelligence community is confident that the Russian government directed the recent compromises of emails from the DNC. They've further said that these thefts are, quote, intended to interfere with the U.S. election process. I have Jack Goldsmith here, I have Susan Hennessy here, to go over all the weird details of this story, which has been a bit overshadowed this week by allegations of groping, but will be a big component of the run-up to the 2016 presidential election. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 192. We're getting close to 200, folks. Jack Goldsmith and Susan Hennessy on Russian interference in the U.S. election. All right, let's start with an overview of the situation, Susan. DNC hacks, it's all been conflated in a lot of people's mind with WikiLeaks, with the substance of, you know, John Podesta's risotto recipe, and with, you know, all kinds of other things. What happened and what has the U.S. intelligence community had to say about it? Give us the sort of 2-minute overview.
Okay, so the timeline really does go all the way back to February of this year. So the intelligence community, DNI James Clapper, gives a public statement where he says that the intelligence community believes that there is foreign interference with the elections, or foreign interference with the political campaigns. So sort of a vague warning, got a little bit of attention, nobody really paid it much mind. The FBI did indicate that they were, quote, providing support to the campaigns. So flash forward to May. And CrowdStrike releases sort of an incendiary report. So in the period of time between February and May, the DNC had learned that they were the target of a probable intrusion, clearly were provided support by the FBI, but also hired CrowdStrike to sort of conduct an independent forensic assessment. And then what was rather rare was they actually authorized CrowdStrike to make that report public. So what CrowdStrike's report essentially said was not only that there was this sort of massive intrusion into the DNC, but they specifically attributed the activity to Russian actors, to particular groups. Kind of the initial response to that was, well, you have a pretty, you have a decent technical case, not a slam dunk. So nobody was quite sure whether or not to believe CrowdStrike. It's become a little bit trendy to kind of blame Russian hackers for everything.
Yeah, Russia's the new China in cyber.
Exactly. Or the cyber caliphate. That was the last, like, cool one. The presumption was this is kind of ordinary espionage. Then this website shows up, purportedly run by Guccifer 2.0, Guccifer. I still have not figured out the pronunciation, claiming to be an independent hacker. I think he claims to be Romanian. The really significant thing, though, is that he gives a document to Gawker. And that document was the DNC's early oppo file on Donald Trump, very broad outlines. And that included metadata that provided a lot more strength to the case that sort of Russia was behind this. And that's really where sort of the, hysteria or sort of the avalanche starts. Following that first release, large quantities of documents start coming out. So first it starts coming out through this independent site, this DC Leaks. And then there's also indication Guccifer says that he's also shared them with WikiLeaks. At the same time, the FBI indicates that it's not just the DNC that's been hacked, also the DCCC, potentially some Republican political organizations. It's not entirely clear. There's sort of this broad, this sense that there's been very broad intrusions. The significant thing that's happened between now and then is, one, the intelligence community has come forward and said, off the record, had leaked to reporters that they had high confidence that Russia was behind these attacks. There's been sort of a broad understanding of Russian involvement, although no public attribution. And then separate reports begin to emerge of Russian intrusions into election infrastructure, right? So voter registration systems and also actually the machines themselves, sort of scanning and probing activities. And so the Department of Homeland Security has issued a number of reports. At first, there were reports of two states, Arizona and Illinois, then a dozen states, then more than 20 states. And there's sort of been a broad rising anxiety about the security of the election infrastructure. And then this broad emerging narrative that the Russians are trying to influence the U.S. presidential campaign, presumably in favor of Donald Trump. So last Friday, the administration, the Department of Homeland Security and ODNI released a statement where they gave relatively detailed attribution, both saying that the Russian government in particular was responsible for the computer intrusions, that they were motivated by a desire to, quote, interfere with the U.S. elections, and then that there was indications that they were involved in other activity, including the leaking and intrusions into the election infrastructure systems, although with a slightly lower level of certainty. That's where we are now. The broad question is the U.S. government going to respond? They said that there will be, quote, a proportional response. It may or may not be visible. And then the question really becomes how it might respond.
So, Jack, you were immediately critical of this statement as not inducing a real deterrence. So what was wrong in your view with what the executive branch said last week?
So this comes against the backdrop of similar episodes and similar reactions to similar episodes. In reaction to the Sony hack, there were news stories for weeks and weeks about how the United States couldn't decide how to respond. It was having trouble figuring out how to respond. Ultimately, there may or may not have been a response. The OPM hack, in addition to some members of the intelligence community actually praising...
Yeah, saying it's fine. That's fair game.
DNI Clapper said it was probably China that did it, and I applaud them. But there was a David Sanger story last summer saying the administration had decided that The Opium Pact was such a severe intelligence loss that they had decided they had to retaliate against China. And there was no retaliation against China for the Opium Hack. And there were similar, in the Sanger story, there were very similar statements to the one Josh Earnest made last week about, we'll do it at the time of our choosing, it may or may not be secret, etc.
And do we know that there was no response, or do we merely know that there was no public response and China has not acknowledged a response?
What David Sanger and Nicole Perloth reported last weekend, kind of in passing in one of their stories, that in fact there had been no response. And they suggested, and this takes us off on a different tangent, so I'll just lay it down here, they suggested that the lack of a response to the OPM hack was actually part of the cyber deal on IP theft, which puts that whole deal in a completely different light, if true. But that's getting us off a little bit.
The other thing that occurred is that the Chinese did arrest individuals in China that they claimed to be responsible, so non-government actors. So there was sort of, whether or not there's a real case there, they did...
Right. They did do something.
They did do something.
Although you might think that the intelligence losses were so large that arresting a few people wasn't much of a fair trade-off for the United States. In any event, so I simply pointed out that, I mean, I wasn't completely critical of the response because we don't know what they're going to do. I just simply made a few points. The first one is that they said that the response might be secret. And Admiral Rogers also said last week that just because you don't see anything going on in response doesn't mean there isn't something going on in response. And I take that, and I hope it's true, certainly, that we can impose pain on our adversaries in private, maybe in ways that we can't do in public, and maybe that's more effective. But one point is that it's very hard to shame an adversary who, if you're responding in private. And more importantly, and this was, again, a theme that Sanger has been saying in stories for years about these hacks, it's very hard to deter third parties if the response is secret, because the third parties can't tell if there was, in fact, a response or whether it was proportionate. So it's, and there seems to be some, and again, the Sanger story last weekend with Perloth went through all the difficulties the United States has in coming up with a proper response. And the main problem, to put it in a nutshell, is that, and we've seen this time and time again, the United States worries that its responses may induce, its retaliation may reduce retaliation by our adversaries, where we end up being in a worse place. So that the escalatory model ends up not working in our favor. The escalation ends up not working in our favor. And I think that this has been a problem time and time again, that our deep dependency on digital networks, the fact that our IT firms, that the most powerful IT firms in the world are American, the fact that we have so much at stake digitally to lose, seems to be hindering us from responding to these attacks.
All right. So first, I want to zero base this conversation and start with a question that everybody always assumes the answer to, but I don't think we should assume it, which is, how big a problem is it if the Russians are hacking our political parties? I can totally understand it's a big problem if they hack vote counting machines or voter registration machines, but why should we think of it, or maybe should we think of it, as a particularly big deal if they're going after the infrastructure of, you know, for exploitation and leaks purposes of, you know, John Podesta's Twitter account or John Podesta's emails? Why shouldn't we take the view, it's exactly the same view that we take with respect to U.S. industry, which is, it's your job to protect your data. If you don't protect your data as a political campaign, you might get embarrassed by revelations when foreign actors, or for that matter, anonymous, goes into it. What should we really be tying ourselves in knots about this, rather than saying, yeah, you know, foreign actors are going to want to hack our political parties. That's a good reason for those political parties to invest some money in cybersecurity.
So I'm not going to answer that question, but I want to sharpen it, and then maybe Susan can answer it. So I think the analogy is not to businesses, you need to take care of themselves. I think the analogy is to state-on-state espionage. Why is this form of espionage plus publication, assuming everything is truthful, why is that worse than the OPM hack, which was enormously damaging? I think that's been, I think we can't begin to appreciate how much damage and compromise was done to the intelligence services by the theft of those millions of security clearance documents. And just to put it in perspective, and this is not to defend what Russia did, nor is it to say we shouldn't take it very seriously, but there was a recent study of electoral interference during the Cold War, and something like 11% of elections during the Cold War involved interference by one of the two major powers, the Soviet Union and the United States, and the United States was responsible for two-thirds of them. We've been in the business of influencing elections for a long time through covert action. We've been in the business of misinformation campaigns for a long time. And the last thing is, it does not obviously violate international law if you care about that. It doesn't rise to the level of interference, which involves an element of coercion under international law. Intervention, I mean, which involves an element of coercion under international law. So that's just background. You know, we do this kind of thing. We don't necessarily do it on this scale because cyber makes everything different. And it doesn't violate international law. And it doesn't seem to be working if the Russians are trying to influence the election in favor of Trump. And yet it is very worrisome.
I don't know how bad his polls would be without their help.
Maybe.
So I think there are two answers to that, to the question of sort of why should we care about political parties, and sort of Jack's more specific point about why this is different. So the first one about, like, should we care about this? So you mentioned that obviously if it's election infrastructure and they're changing the vote counts, that's a problem. But the political parties, maybe that's not. This is a question of line drawing that sort of exists in lots of different contexts of critical infrastructure. So yes, certainly anything that is privately owned, any privately owned network, part of the onus has to be on the network owners. It has to be on people to have strong passwords. Like there's a lot of interest in how to sort of get sort of just raise the tide of sort of the general level of cybersecurity because it's such a distributed threat. But the question was sort of becomes, where is the government going to invest their resources, and where do you draw the line, right? So okay, if like the molten core of our concern about election infrastructure is the machines that tally the ballots, what about voter registration, right? So you could imagine a situation where somebody, you know, a privately owned voter registration list, you know, was hacked and you selectively deregistered or changed the party registrations, right? There's subtle ways you actually could really change things. Okay, so that gets closer. Then you sort of have these political parties that are sort of part of the sort of core functioning of the electoral process. And I agree, it's a gray area. And I actually don't think that the administration views that hack as a line. I think one of the reasons why we didn't see attribution until now, right? So the administration was sort of happy to sit back and have some speculation and even took some hits, right? So, you know, Adam Schiff and Dianne Feinstein, you know, issuing open letters, there were a lot of sort of public criticism. I think they had sort of the same sensibility, right? It's your private emails, you know, choose better passwords. Don't click on phishing links. And so I think that's a challenge that exists in a lot of different places. Sort of, where are we going to draw the line in terms of what is it acceptable to mess with? Where are we going to invest state resources and really wanting things to be defended? And like, is the operative feature the amount of state control or the ability to sort of wreak havoc, right? And that's, we've really done sort of the, we've gone thus far in on sort of the how much trouble could you cause model, right? So we have strong investment in, for example, privately owned electric grids, things like that, whenever we think about critical infrastructure. Then there's this separate component, which I think goes to Jack's question, and that is, what about this weird hybrid information warfare? So certainly malicious cyber intrusions are not new. Certainly information warfare is not new. But what is emerging, and sort of Sony is probably the first kind of high profile example, is the combination of the two in sort of a weaponized fashion.
So stealing stuff and then leaking it.
Stealing massive volumes of stuff and then leaking it on a very large scale, right, in ways that become where the intention is not necessarily targeted, but just to kind of create chaos, embarrassment, economic damage.
But again, what's new there is only the scale.
Right.
Theft plus publication for information, for propaganda, and for influencing domestic populations is as old as espionage.
Right, but I think the question of vulnerability goes to why should we care about this, right? So this is a place in which we are tremendously vulnerable, maybe uniquely vulnerable. It's not really probable that we can actually get our cybersecurity, right? So deterrence by denial, everyone just has great cybersecurity and nobody can get in anywhere. So it would seem like there's it's important to try and create some norms around this. I think that's why there's sort of there's new anxiety. Also, the notion that kind of everybody's a fair target now. So WikiLeaks initially was kind of the State Department cable. So sort of a, you know, privacy for, you know, privacy for everyone, transparency for the state. It was sort of, okay, the state isn't entitled to privacy. Then it was sort of... you know, large private companies. Now it's anyone involved in a political campaign. This kind of the sense of anybody's fair game.
So why isn't the right response to this to steal a large cache of roughly comparably sensitive stuff from, you know, some entity that has close relationship with the Russian government and dump it all out in public in a fashion to be maximally embarrassing? Why isn't
that? That might be the right response in the first round, but then the question is, what would they do in response? What kind of information? I mean, are they going to steal and publish? And who's going to end up winning that repeated game?
I don't even think that it necessarily is right in the first instance, because I think you have two pretty substantial risks. One is that it's probably not going to work, right? We have a very different culture than Russia, for example. So, you know, if you leak information that the U.S. politician has offshore accounts and isn't paying their taxes, that has an effect, right? That's sort of contrary to social expectations. If you tell people in Russia that, you know, oligarchs and Putin, you know, have secret bank accounts, I don't think it gets the same kind of
assuming
bounce.
They find out about it.
Right, exactly. So one, there's better control over the media, but two, I think even if that information does come out, I just don't think there's the same kind of societal effects.
Okay, so then imagine now that you are in charge of our deterrence strategy, and you're confronted with this new, Jack's point is well taken. At the micro level, it's not new at all, but the scaling of it to massive databases is new.
And what's new is that we are very much on the receiving end of it.
Right.
It's been very hard to influence our elections until this technology comes.
So we're on the receiving end of it. And by the way, you notice that it has state-sponsored components like North Korea and like this episode. But it also has individual level components like Chelsea Manning and Snowden, the latter of whom may or may not have had some degree of foreign engagement. I don't want to make allegations about that, but they certainly ended up in Moscow, and there are a lot of people who pose the question of what level of state sponsorship that whole episode may have had. And so I guess my question is, how do you think about what a cyber deterrent strategy against this sort of thing looks like? And do you say the basic strategy is to deter online what is happening online? Or is your basic approach, we have a lot of tools in our relationship with Russia, And, you know, if they want to do this, maybe the Ukrainians get a better weapon system than they otherwise would have gotten. I mean, you sort of deter offline activity that happens online.
So, look, I think
I just want
anyone...
the record to reflect here that Jack immediately looked to Susan and is
I have
just,
views, but
just
I want to hear
what
Susan has first. No, I have views. I think it's easy to ask and hard to answer, but go ahead.
Right, exactly. So I think anyone who sort of says, oh, you know, there's the obvious answer to this. It's enormously complex. It's almost impossible to know where we are in the escalation deterrence cycle. Different adversaries are different, right? So there might be a case for actually secret retaliation with Russia that might actually be more helpful because it might reduce the escalation because there's less of sort of a pride feature. There's complex dimensions. You know, if I were king, and you know, in Trump's America, maybe we'll revert to a monarchy or change to a monarchy. You know, I think you have to do two things. One, I think you have to draw really firm lines about what is it, where is it acceptable to mess around and where is it not, right? It's not possible to say nobody can mess with anything in the United States. You know, touching a United States network or computer is unacceptable, or even, you know, a government system, right? You have to send very firm messages about, for example, you mess with our political parties, we're annoyed, maybe we'll retaliate, but you touch our election infrastructure and there will be a consequence. And I think the administration has a little bit gone all in on this notion of, well, we want to be ambiguous, right? We don't want people to know exactly where the thresholds are because we don't want to sort of allow people to do just what they can get away with. I think that maybe is not working here, right? There is some validity in saying, all right, this is the stuff we just will not tolerate and cannot tolerate, and being really clear and really standing behind that. So wanting to be very serious about only designating systems as critical infrastructure that we actually view as critical, and not playing games where afterwards we say, oh, well, Sony is a telecommunication. That's critical. I mean, this thing where everything in the world is critical infrastructure, that makes it really hard for an adversary to make a reasonable calculation about where they can act and where they can't.
Yeah, Sony isn't a critical infrastructure, but Netflix sure is. Jack, what do you think?
So I just think that I agree with Susan in theory. The people in the government, I think, agree with that in theory. I don't have the language of our we actually have a doctrine about responding to cyber attacks, and I don't have it in front of me, but it's a publicly available doctrine. But it's extremely vague. It basically says something to the effect that the United States reserves the right to respond in cyber or not in cyber to something like a serious attack, cyber attack, something to that effect. So it's the opposite of precise. It's very vague. I think it's hard to draw red lines in this context. What constitutes the election infrastructure? That could mean so many things. And this is one of the problems. You need to draw, to have deterrence, you need to draw a clear line, which is extremely hard to do because there are an infinite number of targets. And even if we could say, some people say civilian networks. Well, what exactly is that and what constitutes a breach of that? That has to be known both to the adversary and for us to have a swift response. Then we have to make this old-fashioned deterrence model work. Even if we drew a red line, we'd actually have to commit to retaliating in the face of that. That is hard for a number of reasons. One, because, the main reason it's hard is because the escalation models or the escalation scenarios always look like or often look like we're going to end up being hurt more than we're helped. A lot of people in the government that I've talked to have reached the conclusion that the nuclear form of deterrence or the old-fashioned forms of deterrence where you draw a clear line, you respond with overwhelming force if you violate that, and therefore you deter someone from crossing that line is just not going to work, and that the only hope we have in deterrence, in general terms, is deterrence by defense, which means defending the networks better, which is also not a great way to go. So the reason that the United States government dawdles in response to each one of these is not because there aren't a lot of smart people who've been working on this problem for years and years and years. It's just not. It's very hard to generalize about what a deterrence doctrine should be.
So why shouldn't the generalization be the following? And I'm being simplistic here on purpose. Yes, online we have more vulnerability than anybody else because we have more investment than anybody else. But offline, most countries want things from us. And so the basic rule is we will attribute publicly, and everything you want from the United States will be harder to get once, you know, from military cooperation to, you know, to sanctions relief with respect to Ukraine, to, you know, countries want things from us to better trade relations.
What does that look like concretely with the Russians? I mean, we're already sanctioning them. We're adversaries along a number of dimensions with them, and those relationships are getting worse. I mean, I think it's important to not separate what's going on here from those relationships. But what does that look like concretely? And well, why can't they so what does it look like concretely, and why isn't the escalation point still valid there?
Well, so number one, I think you could say, first of all, the escalation point isn't still valid because we're not more vulnerable in other areas.
They don't have to respond. They can respond in cyber to anything we do to them in non-cyber.
That's right. It's just a question of whether we can exact a price in. The point about responding in cyber is that we cannot exact a price that's higher than the price they can exact in retaliation. But when you go off cyber, you say, well, then you have the whole world of U.S. policy leverage. And I think that the opportunities to say we will increase the amount of banking sanctions, we will increase, both targeted and untargeted banking sanctions. We will increase assistance to the government of Ukraine. We will increase assistance to the governments of Georgia and Estonia. You know, all these various countries that you've menaced, we're going to make your life more difficult in those contexts as long as we feel you are threatening our interest in cyberspace.
So I think one of the challenges here is that there's a desire to have one single deterrent strategy instead of potentially a bifurcated approach. Right, one of the reasons why sort of the nuclear deterrence model doesn't work is because we aren't talking about building capacity, right? It's not you're deterring conduct. You're trying to deter conduct that in a lot of cases isn't that hard to do, and there's sort of a different feature. There is obviously one area in which we apparently are successful at deterring, and also that I don't think that there would be sort of dithering, right? And that's that there are clearly forms of cyber attacks, right? Things that threatened people's lives or sort of potentially came up against that kind of armed attack where, you know, look, maybe the administration would quibble over how hard to hit or where, but there's no question that there would be an immediate, very strong response, and there's no question that that activity would be immediately identifiable. So there's sort of the very serious space and sort of what a deterrence model there would need to look like. And then there's a sort of a different space. So Eric Rosenbach talks about the space between. It's not quite so. Phil Walter wrote a piece on Lawfare, sort of in the traditional deterrence context, where he talked about this below established threshold activity, right? So, it's the need to engage on stuff. It's stuff that crosses the line that requires a response that you can't ignore, but it isn't that really, really serious thing. It's not the thing that you want to go nuclear over, right? And this is the area where we're really seeing the administration struggle. And I have to say, the suspicion that every single time that there's sort of one of these episodes, the administration seems to be scrambling to identify if it should respond and how it should respond. Those are the two questions, which I think a little bit raises the specter that maybe there's not actually a policy at all. Maybe just something happens and then they kind of play it by ear. That strikes me as problematic.
Or I would say that they do have a policy at some general level, but every episode is a surprise to them. Sony was something that they admitted they had not anticipated. OPM, obviously a surprise because the networks weren't defended. The election stuff, we're clearly scrambling. We hadn't anticipated that. And there's just thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of possible targets. And it's each one presents unique questions of attribution, of harm, of proportional response, of blowback, and the like.
Okay, so I want to shift gears here and talk about the Donald Trump factor. which you could also call the WikiLeaks factor. Is this the same issue if it happens, you know, if the nominee is Marco Rubio and it comes out that the FSB has stolen a bunch of DNC emails and starts leaking them, and the Republican candidate for president responds the way any normal Republican candidate for president would respond, which is to say, it's outrageous that a foreign actor would be engaged in our political campaigns. I don't want any kind of I don't want there to be any question about how strongly I denounce this. And certainly I don't want anybody vote on the basis of the activity of a foreign power in our electoral system, which is the way I think any normal political candidate of either party would respond.
Then to immediately pivot to the substance.
Right? And then, yeah, sure, there's no exclusionary rule on the substance of the emails. But so, yeah, then they would talk about that. And by the way, Hillary Clinton would do exactly the same thing if roles were reversed. But there was a set of rules that all political candidates would have played by that Trump has violated or changed this norm completely. And so my question is, how much of the oddity of the feel of this is just a reflection of the weirdness with which the candidate slash beneficiary has responded to it, and how much of it is organic to the operation itself?
So I think a little bit. We are just in a strange moment. And certainly part of it is some of the novel features of sort of the Trump candidacy. But there's a lot of stuff going on. We have 8 Supreme Court justices. Even before Trump, there was sort of a sense
I knew Merrick Garland was going to get blamed for this somehow.
you know, even sort of, you know, even prior to Trump's candidacy, there was sort of a sense that we were really kind of at a low point in terms of sort of the party relationships and functional governance. And so I think that there's a general sense of vulnerability. Whenever the Trump is really, it's gasoline on a fire, right? It's in ordinary times that, you know, if we were being messed with, I think there would be more confidence that there was resiliency, right? That the U.S. system was strong enough to sort of ingest that information, filter out the kind of the foreign influence intent, assess the substance, and make a decision. And maybe that might be wrong in reality. But at least there was that sensibility. Now I think we're in a place of unique vulnerability or just unique anxiety, and so that is making the attempts at interference especially scary, because it feels like they all of a sudden maybe they could work, right? Our resiliency feels lower.
I guess I agree with that. I think that it's impossible to say, but I think a lot of it has to do with Trump. I mean, he's not just. He's a candidate who basically is challenging the entire elite establishment on foreign policy and saying we shouldn't worry so much about Russia. And he's basically has flipped the foreign policy establishment in his views. That is by itself, that and the possibility that he will win, which seems dim now, has been hugely anxiety promoting. And then to have that connected to interference with the electoral system and the suggestion that Trump and his team are somehow working hand in hand to make it happen, I think there's no doubt that that's part of the anxiety. I think it also is the concern that, as Susan said earlier, it will go beyond mere theft and publication to somehow interfering with the electoral results themselves, with the possible with the possible nightmare scenario that there's a contested election and that we don't know what the reality was. So those combination of things, I believe, are really making this a much bigger deal than it would otherwise be.
And just to be clear, do we think that there is any significant chance of an interference in actual vote counting, or is that merely a hypothetical possibility?
No, so this is sort of, this is the fine line. And a little bit you see the FBI and DHS kind of trying to walk it. So one is, it'd be really, really hard to change the outcome of an election, right? We have enough backups, our systems are sort of old and distributed enough, and it's really not plausible that you could change a vote without it being detectable after the fact, let alone that you could do it on a wide enough scale to actually change the outcome of an election. I think that is valid.
You don't think that they could cause a lack of confidence in the numbers? I don't.
So I think that's a distinct question, right?
But
so
that's just as bad. Could be just as bad, couldn't it?
Well, yes and no, right? So no, I think it's worse if they actually end up if there's actual evidence that they've changed the election and we can't figure it out. I mean,
right.
that's
what I
worry
about.
Catastrophic. Even if there's just a sense of genuine uncertainty, it's hard to know how seriously to take a group of people. Undeniably, there are a group of individuals who are supporting Donald Trump that talk about things that sound like armed insurrection, right? They talk about like taking up arms and bloodshed after, is that just crazy campaign rhetoric? Probably. I'm not sure anyone's really concerned about that. But that's the sort of, right, having elections be decisively quickly called is kind of important to peaceful transitions of power. Yeah, then there's also the question of, are we going to learn the right lesson, right? So guess what? Our election infrastructure actually is kind of a mess. And even if it can't be, maybe this particular manifestation isn't going to work to change the election, but we're hardly in a position where we can sit back and be like, oh no, we're fine. We don't need to do anything, right? There has to be sort of thought about where we want to go from here. So there's sort of the desire to preserve, address the immediate situation, right? The election is safe. Whoever we vote for, that's going to be properly recorded. They are going to become president of the United States. Everybody needs to calm down. Then there's part two, which is everybody needs to kind of freak out. This is a really important thing. We've failed on cybersecurity in all kinds of contexts. Some maybe aren't so important. Some, it turns out, are really, really important. And we're going to have to get our act together there.
On that note, thank you, Jack. Thank you, Susan, for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with, guess who? The Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Jack and Susan for coming to the Jungle Studio for this recording session. You need to do your part to promote the Lawfare Podcast, tweet the Lawfare Podcast, share on Facebook the Lawfare Podcast, talk annoyingly to your friends at dinner parties about the Lawfare Podcast. Our music is performed, as usual, by the Right Honorable Sophia Yan. Thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.